earth may change from summer green to winter white. The brightest day can change into the darkest night. A gray cloud may change a sky of blue, but nothing ever changes my love for you. A gentle breeze can blow into a hurricane. A happy song can change into a sad refrain. The oak leaf will fall when autumn's through, but nothing ever changes my love for you. Time will alter Gibraltar, the seas may run dry, but you'll see that we'll be the same, you and I. A million things are bound to change as time rolls on. A million springs will come and go, and when they're gone, my darling, the thrill will still be new. For nothing ever changes my love for you.
All right, I'd like to call the meeting to order. This is the Parks and Rec Commission meeting for Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. Let's jump right into our agenda here. All right, first of all, we've got roll call. Oops, I'm sorry. Let me see. My last round is chairman. I'm screwing it up already. Pledge of Allegiance, please. Will you please stand? Thank you, and may we now have roll call.
Commissioner Barsky? Commissioner Jones?
Here.
Commissioner Lynn?
Here.
Commissioner Tolis?
Here.
Vice Chair West?
Here.
Chair Hart?
Here.
All right, thank you very much. Moving right along. We have public forum. Are there any speaker slips?
I have no speakers for public forum.
All right. Keep rolling on here. So we've got item A, a presentation 8.1, UCSB North Campus Open Space Project.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. This item is at the request of one of the commission members, Commissioner Lynn, to have a presentation on the UCSB North Campus Open Space Project. So we have a member of UCSB here tonight. In fact, we have Mr. Mark Fisher, the Associate Vice Chancellor at UCSB, and a great partner in a lot of things that we work together on with UCSB on many projects. So it's great to see Mark and a number of folks here. So, Mr. Fisher, are you doing the presentation tonight? Okay, great. So we'd like to welcome Mr. Mark Fisher to the podium for tonight's presentation on this item.
So how can I control the slides, Vito? Oh.
We'll give you there's a clicker here for you. And you're good to go.
Good evening, everybody. So I'm very happy tonight to be able to talk about our North Campus Open Space Project. This is a project we've been working on for 3 years. Is that right? It's a gift from the Trust for Public Land, gave the university 64 acres, the former Ocean Meadow Golf Course. Last week, we took this through Coastal Commission, and we're happy to receive unanimous approval from the Coastal Commission last Thursday for the project. So we are moving forward. So tonight we'll talk a little bit about context, history, goals, hydrology, restoration, access, and schedule. And I'm joined tonight by Lisa Stratton, who's part of our CBER group, the Cheadle Center for Biodiversity and Ecological Restoration. Lisa's really the heart and soul of this project, and she can help me fill in gaps if we need. And Bob Silsby from my office is also here, who's been involved with this piece of land, the land around it, for 20-plus years probably at this point. So a really strong history with both of them. This is the project site. It's the orange on the map. They're all a little different color here. But on the map, the orange area is the project site. It includes both the old Ocean Meadows Golf Course and also something we call South Parcel. This was part of a land purchase more than 20 years ago that included the light blue area above the golf course. These three areas combined were part of a regrading project in the 1960s that filled what was a slough and made the golf course. So the end goal of this is to try to restore to the extent possible that slough configuration that would have predated the 1960s. And you'll see in here some ideas about what it was like historically. This diagram, for example, is 19th century, and this shows the original shape of the slough. And if you imagine about 50% of that sort of odd shaped thing is still there, the lower portion. The upper portion then, of course, was filled and became the golf course, and parts of it actually were filled and now have houses sitting on it. So it's definitely been transformed over time. This is the condition in 1967 when they were filling after they'd filled and built the golf course. But you can see the areas that they excavated, where there's a lot of soil removal south of the golf course and north of the golf course. That's where the soil came from that actually filled the piece of land in the middle and created the golf course. As I said to the Coastal Commission last week, this was never a very good golf course. And I think one of the issues was it was always wet. It was swampy because it was basically built in a wetland. So it was always compromised because of that. There's some very lucky things about the golf course. It wasn't exactly a pristinely maintained golf course. So it didn't have the usual pesticides and fertilizer that you might expect. So part of the restoration here is made simpler for us because it wasn't maintained maybe at the highest of standards in the golf course industry. So that's a lucky break. This is what an overlay showing what that historic slough shape would have been on the current condition. And you can see on the upper right-hand side that fingers of that slough went up into residential neighborhoods. For those of you who might live in the neighborhood, you know that there's kind of a pond up there that's wet, and there's been some flooding issues in that particular area. And it probably, again, has a lot to do with the history of the land and the fact that it was a wetland and probably really wants to be a wetland again. But this is a good reference drawing for us because it starts to describe what we're trying to do. As a reminder, every now and then, in its recent history, it turns back into a wetland, a slough. And this is after one of the rainstorms in 2010. We haven't had a lot of this over the recent years, but we've seen kayaks out there, and we know that this becomes kind of a water sport area when it's wet. So, and the swan comes and goes. We have a pair of swans that float around. This is the project, if you will, that as it's developing. That cross section there shows you what we're doing with soils. Basically, we're taking the soil out of the slough configuration and moving it to the south parcel and trying to recreate the landform that was there before. It's probably a little higher than it was before, but it lets us make an even cut and fill on this site so that we don't have to export soil. So that's really important for us. We think it's environmentally the most sound thing to do, and it creates some really interesting opportunities in terms of the ecology and our ability to create different plant communities. And again, I'm not the expert, Lisa is, and she can jump in and correct me. There's also been a lot of discussion about trails and access. Because this was a trust for public land purchase, there's always been an interest in restoration, creating this restoration area, obviously, and doing that with a strong scientific purpose, but also that the public should be allowed into this space. This is not like the reserve just to the south, which is basically fenced off and not accessible. This is a space designed for the public to engage in this restoration area. And while it doesn't have active play spaces, there are hiking trails and bicycles are allowed on parts of this, and you'll be able to walk dogs on a leash. But it really has a lot of public access and is, again, very different than the reserve from that perspective. Having said that, it has some of the same goals in terms of plant community and ecological restoration that the reserve has. So we're still talking about local seed genome. We're still talking about doing this in a very sensitive way that really replicates what would have been there historically. So while it's scientifically, I would say, fairly pure, it also has this public access overlay, which is exciting. Just as a reminder there, size-wise, at 51.5 acres, how much of this is subtidal, the flooded channel, the kind of middle part, and then there'll be mud flats, salt marsh, and then there's this kind of intermittent condition out there, which we have today. So if you were out there today, my memory is because we were out there yesterday, it's just the piece of water in the middle, but oftentimes the sandbar is in place and this floods and turns into something that looks like a lake. So the new condition north of the bridge will be very similar in terms of having different conditions. This just begins to show water level, possible water levels. The dark blue in the bottom represents where we think we'll have water most of the year, and then areas that'll be drier, and then the sort of mud flats up on the side. And one of those mud flats, which is kind of a tan area, center bottom, just kind of tan or brown, is an area where we think we might actually have some extended snowy plover habitat if we can create the right kind of conditions. So a lot of variation in terms of plant community and different ecological conditions here because of the topography. So between areas that are, for the most part, wet, seasonally wet, moist on the edges, and there's some vernal pools in here, and then the upland areas, a lot of different conditions, which the biologists are excited about. And this also is an important part of the plan in terms of Coastal Commission approval and the current thinking about the coast. A lot of concern about sea level rise and what happens with sea level rise. So we were encouraged by the Coastal Commission staff to also think about in this project how it would respond to sea level rise. And now a lot of our projects, we're actually having to sign indemnification waivers if the sea level rises that we don't hold the Coastal Commission harmless. And we hold them harmless, but we don't hold them accountable for conditions. So this starts to map what we think will happen with sea level rise. This is showing the project under 3 feet of sea level rise, which I think is about maybe 2050. It depends on who's describing sea level rise, what the conditions might be. But this was part of the thought process as well. Restoration section, so obviously diverse wetland and upland habitats, I described that, trying to conserve and enhance existing habitats. There's not a lot out there that's really pristine. There are some areas that are curious and interesting in the southwest corner, and then obviously looking at endangered species and biodiversity. And then this is the plan as it developed, and this was after a lot of input from the community, Trust for Public Land, public meetings we participated. There was quite a bit of community participation. We've taken this back out in several meeting formats after that participation. And then on the campus side, because, you know, it is university property, we were really interested in the science. So the chancellor created something he called the Science Advisory Committee, and they spent about 2 years really noodling on this project, and they picked everything apart. So the plan is very similar to the plan that evolved early in the process, but it was the scientists really analyzed it, and they thought, what about the water condition, soil condition, plant community? Will the upland work? If you move soil from A to B, is that soil really viable for this plant community? This was as analyzed as any project I've ever seen, especially what's essentially a large landscape project, became a scientific project, and it's had a lot of review and consultation on the campus. After that, we took the plan back out to the community and presented the evolved plan, which was very similar to the original plan discussed with the community, overlaid with the scientific biological perspective, and then the final plan, which you see here. So what you're seeing here is the orange pathways around the top of the site are essentially primary paths, and they would include bicycle access and pedestrian. They're class 2 road base, which is analogous to DG, but a little bit more stable. I think they're 12 or 15 feet wide. And We'll see in a diagram here in a second. And then there are a couple of bridges, and I don't always get these right, but if you look at, well, you can see the long bridge in the middle, and I think a descriptor in here describes as a 300-foot bridge. It's really a 200-foot bridge. And then that crosses the wetland. And this was in direct consultation with the Safe Routes to School folks and the neighborhood. It provides one of the better access points for people in the neighborhood moving across the open space to Isla Vista School. And a lot of people in this community, their kids are going to IB school these days. Also, it provides access from the neighborhoods to the west and north through the site and onto Stork Road. And obviously, a lot of those people are headed to the campus. We're realistic about that. And that was an important consideration. There are also some bridges in here that are acting more like wooden walkways. And you'll see some pictures in a second. That's sort of upper right. It's a short bridge that's running east-west in that slide. And then on the very east of this, there's a bridge that crosses the wetland that's more of a low water bridge. And then where El Encanto or Phelps Ditch, it has many different names, comes in, there's a bridge that crosses there as well. So a series of bridge structures in here. And in a second, you'll see what those bridges look like. The magenta color trail, at least on that one looks sort of magenta, is a tertiary trail. And that one is not as improved. And that's really, you know, moving in and out of the plant community around the vernal pools. And it's specifically designed to allow access, but it's not encouraging a lot of access. There's kind of a pinky red one that runs along the east northwest side of the site, and that connects that primary trail, it's a secondary trail, west to the community and the mesa on the west and out to the reserve area that the city manages. So we're trying here to connect all the existing trails to the extent possible while creating this new wetland area, and also working with the city on connections for a potential bike lane that runs up along El Encanto Creek that goes up to Hollister that ties into a Class 1 bike path. So a lot of interconnected quality to this in terms of moving both bikes and pedestrians around the site. And did I miss anything there? Some of the plant communities you'll see, so they're uplands and grasslands that you can see here, California coastal sage scrub. And we're, of course, you know, collecting seeds, and I think we've actually started planting some of the south parcel, so parts of this are moving forward. Salt marsh, and I think this is probably similar, that probably is a picture of Carpinteria salt marsh on there, so similar plant community. Obviously, a lot of interest in birds and what this will do for that part of the environmental community. And then more of the grasslands and probably upland plants here on the left. Public access, as I've said, is really important. It's important to us. It was important to the Trust for Public Land, and it's important to the neighbors. This was certainly a lot about balance, not having too much access because it is in their backyard. On the other hand, making it accessible to the larger community. There's a little parking lot that'll be on the northeast side of the site where the old golf course clubhouse was. And that will provide public access for the larger community. And then there are connection points with the neighborhood. And there have been a lot of discussions about where those connection points would be. And some of them, my guess, will evolve over time because they're places where some fences are in place that the neighbors put in place. And it'll just be interesting to see how that evolves as the open space evolves. And then, you know, a lot of ability to move through it. And again, this multimodal issue was important both for us in terms of our commuters, possibly our commuters coming through the community, through this open space. And then also the young people going to school, the Safe Route to School folks wanted both bicycle access and pedestrian access. And then, as I spoke about earlier, bridges, boardwalks, and places to view the landscape, the open space from those walkways. And then the last one there, we have to conserve access for Goleta West Sanitary District. They have a series of manholes along there that we have to make it so they can bring their trucks in and clean out the manholes should they need to. So, you know, interesting overlays, not just preservation or restoration, but the complexity of being in an urban interface is still part of this. And this just shows how the trail system connects. And you can see the brown trails on there. Kind of the local paths that have created over time. And the yellow one is the Anza Coastal Trail, which is developing, and this will be part of that. And I think this is probably our grading plan.
Public access.
Okay, so it shows the trails in a little more detail. And these are the trail sections. So the top one is the tertiary trail. That's the one that really is just a dirt path. The secondary trail is class 2 base, but it's narrower. And my eyesight's not that good, but I think that's 5 to 6 feet wide. And then the bottom one is the primary trail, which is 10 foot wide, I guess, which includes bicycles and pedestrians. So those are the trails. And we're trying, we've learned on campus is that class 2 road base, which is a Caltrans material, is extremely durable and drains well and doesn't get as soupy as decomposed granite, but still has the kind of same aesthetic. So this is what we've been using a lot on campus for the last probably 12 years, I think, starting with Manzanita Village with a lot of success. So that's our proposal here. And then the bridges. So these are the bridges we're proposing. It's similar to the bridge that's out of the Bacara on the wetland area there. It says it's a 300-foot bridge. We've reduced this to a 200-foot bridge, and that was really for cost reasons more than anything else. But I think these are beautiful prefabricated structures. And then on the north side, there's this walkway system we're proposing. So again, you see these in restoration areas, kind of a lovely way to add foot traffic into a space and still preserve the environment in and around it. So that'll be quite nice. And there's that compilation of all those things together. And just some details of the parking area and entrance into the site here, which we're still working on funding for. And then schedule. So we're hoping to go out to bid. I think we have most of the funding in place. Lisa's raised about $12 million. She continues to try to raise funds. It's a, if you think about the short period of time we've owned this property, I'll be honest with you, I didn't think this was possible when this first came out. I thought, oh, this will never happen. But to her credit, she's raised a lot of money with a lot of support from the environmental community in really short order. And this is making this possible. It's split into two construction packages, which has to do with fund sources. But we hope to start construction in the winter and then have this February and have this really finish up at the end of 2017, early 2018. We had a question the other day from a granting agency why we were starting in the rainy season. Those of you who work in the coastal zone know that you have bird issues. I see Darlene here. Bird issues and nesting habitats. So we want to get in and remove trees before nesting season. So that will be one of the things you'll see pretty quickly, and we have approval to do that before we start the larger construction package. And the second thing was most of phase one is on the northern edge of the site and has a lesser impact on the wetlands and the stormwater issues. And the major part of the construction is really March, April, so we're getting toward the end of the rainy season, and then there's a lot of excavation because we're moving all that soil that's in the golf course out to create that new south knoll. So the biggest impact really is just the very end of the rainy season, the beginning of spring and summer. This is phase one, which again is toward the north side of the site. And this is will provide, first of all, some early access, which is nice, and the beginning of restoration of the plant community in there. And again, it stays away from the majority of the wetter areas. And then phase two, which is the really big project. The blue areas here represent excavation. You can see there's a lot of it. And then the red represents where the fill goes. And Lisa, what's the total quantity of soil we're moving?
350,000
cubic yards. So it's a big grading project. This is it's a serious construction project. And then once all this work's done, I think what Lisa probably thinks is the fun part, the planting starts, and that's over 5 years. So this is a slow restoration process once we go, but you know, when you're restoring that many acres, it just takes time, and to do it properly, it really does take time. And if you don't know Lisa's work, you can certainly see it a number of places on campus. Manzanita Village has one of our early restoration projects, the North Bluff, San Clemente Housing. We've done restoration around our North Campus faculty housing. What am I missing? Oh, we just did Sierra Madre work in the Sierra Madre project. So almost all of our recent bigger housing projects have had a pretty substantial restoration project associated with it. And SEBRA has been responsible for all those restorations to date. And they have an extraordinarily good reputation with the Coast Commission and with the granting agencies for the quality of their work and level of thoroughness and passion. There's a lot of passion. So we can entertain questions if you like, or whatever you...
Yes, that'd be great. Well, thank you very much for that presentation. That's very informative. I've known about it just kind of periphery. So I'm a little curious about what the outreach has been to the community and what the major concerns were as a result of that outreach.
So the initial outreach was really handled by the Trust for Public Land as we were transitioning ownership. And they held a series of open workshops out on the site. I think they were generally on Saturdays, and there were some evening workshops too, I guess. We cast a broad net. We used the city's mailing list for that neighborhood. So we really attempted to give everyone probably up to Hollister, whatever that general geographic zone is in the city for outreach. And I think mailers and email, if I recall correctly, but quite a lot of participation. And I'll get to what's happened more recently. And I think a really good input. So there were, you know, everything from, yes, we like this idea a lot. No, we really don't want a really active park, which was interesting. Yes, we like the idea of walking through nature and having this restoration project. We're not interested in having huge numbers of people here, but we're interested in it being open. So the input was good because it generally aligned with what the environmental community was interested in and what we were interested in for the project. So that was all very positive. More recently, there's been a discussion about another bridge that would go, if I can go backwards, maybe, near the intersection of Phelps Ditch or Alicanto Creek and the current bridge. There was an idea of a bridge that would come across. A lot of trepidation about this from an environmental perspective because of where it lands on the South Knoll and what it would do in terms of focusing foot traffic through a more sensitive part of the site. So that issue was brought to the Coastal Commission, and commission staff, their staff biologists, weighed in on it. We basically stayed neutral on the topic. We said to the community, that's the proper place to bring the topic. It's a public forum. It's a chance for you to come in and talk about this. There was a petition from some of the neighbors, and they did make the presentation. Coastal Commission staff wasn't supportive of a second bridge, and the commission wasn't supportive. So anyway, we left it to them ultimately to weigh in on and evaluate the value of adding that second bridge. Realistically, we think we have pretty good access here, frankly, without the second bridge. And I think what's more than the second bridge, but it's the second major crossing. And feel very strongly that this is the right plan going forward, both from an access standpoint, but also from an ecological standpoint. So balance there. So then there were the workshops. There were some public group student or young people projects out there. Lisa held some Saturday things where you could come out and learn about the biology of the site. We've had several follow-up meetings with local homeowners after the plan had solidified, one at the Sierra Madre project, and more recently we did one at our North Campus faculty housing where the larger public came as well. And so we've had quite a bit of public outreach. On the campus side, we have our own internal process, just like you do. We're like a small town. So we have something called the Campus Planning Committee, Design Review Committee. So it's gone through all those committees and process on our campus. And also this Science Advisory Board was also heavily, heavily involved in this. So it's had a lot of consultation. And remember that those of us who work on campus generally live in the community. So there's a lot of overlap between the two communities, if you will, in terms of participation. In fact, John Milak, who's one of the researchers, bicycles across this every day to work. So they have a personal involvement with it beyond their academic involvement. So like everything here, we're all interrelated.
Thank you. Other mm-hmm. questions?
I just wanted to say how exciting this is. I attended several of those public hearings, and I received notification through the excellent job that the city of Goleta had let people know about it. But really, I was just wondering, it sounds so wonderful. Did anybody research if there would be benefits to the monarch butterflies at all? I mean, I know that's a little more north.
Do you want to come up, Lisa? Lisa probably should come up.
The You know, there's two parts of the monarch butterfly need. There's the grove, you know, and that role wouldn't, obviously we're not planting any eucalyptus or removing more than a few scattered on the golf course. But part of our grassland plan does include planting milkweed. So we will be providing larval support and things. So that is some component of the project.
So much, Steve. I'm sure there'll be other questions I can't cover.
Go ahead.
I only have one question, and it involves public access, and it's kind of like a tough one because the neighborhood may or may not like it, but I have to ask it. At the end of Scripps Crescent, there is a wooden fence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who owns that land. If it's not privately owned, that really should be open. And I know that the homeowners in that street probably don't like that idea, but that's my only kind of lingering issue, because people are going to have to climb over that fence.
Right. It is privately owned. The piece of land from the cul-de-sac to our property line is owned by that community, the
University Village.
So it's under their control. The fence was repaired after we bought the property. It's a low fence, split rail. It's one of the details, I think, as we get closer to opening, hopefully that dialogue could be, you know, started up again. It would be nice to go through that and just say, is it possible to open it? I think you're right. People are just going to climb it, frankly. So, but I think we have to finish it, show the value of the new restoration, and then I think that will probably lead to a different discussion. So, yeah. Unfortunately, it's not ours, and it's not city property either. Yeah.
Commissioner Johnson?
Thank you so much for a very thorough and very interesting presentation. And congratulations on getting through the Coastal Commission process.
Yeah.
That is a feat in itself. So I had a couple questions, so I'll just go through all of them and you can circle back.
Okay.
I'm just curious how much parking is going to be provided in the parking lot. And then on the grading, that's a lot of movement. Is that all staying on site and being moved to the Knoll area, or is there any export? And then does UCSB or is UCSB going to utilize this in any way with their Bryn School or environmental studies as a learning opportunity? And what type of follow-up programs in place to ensure success, or how are you going to monitor that?
So let me start with the earthwork. That's probably the easiest one for me, at least. So, yes, the idea is the soil stays on site. So excavation and moving it on site. In terms of scientific research, I think absolutely, because it's going to provide that sort of experimental place where you can come and see. And remember, the people working on this are faculty members involved with Bryn. So I think they'll be very interested in how this performs. And I'm sure the graduate students will take this on as an experiment, or at least, you know, analyzing the effects of what we've done. For example, when you take the soil out of the golf course and move it upland, did it perform? I mean, that's going to be an interesting question. The mud flats, they really operate like we thought they would. Will snowy plovers really populate a part of this? There's some skepticism because it's on the north side of that bridge. Will the plovers go there? And I think those are the sorts of things that I think the scientific community would be very interested in. Let me think, what were the other parts of the question?
Parking.
It's 30 spaces, right? 30 spaces okay. For parking. And that's basically, again, where the clubhouse is. The funny little parking lot that the clubhouse had, we don't own all of. The original property owner maintained a piece of that. So while there may be more spaces there now, we'll be shrinking that down to the 30 spaces.
And then I'm just curious about what type of program you have in place to monitor the success of the restoration.
You want to talk about that?
We'll be talking about programming too for the site.
Right. So we have a whole monitoring plan that, you know, we'll be monitoring topography and erosion. We'll be monitoring plant success. We'll be monitoring for tidewater goby, one of the endangered species we're hoping to support, and regular bird surveys and that sort of thing, hydrological monitoring in terms of, you know, what are the water levels, you know, are we getting tidal flow when we think it is, how does it respond long-term to sea level rise? Mm-hmm. And one of the models that was done for the project showed that flood elevations would drop by about 2 feet, you know, compared to current conditions. So we'll be able to monitor that kind of thing and document that. And all of our, between the grants and the permits. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of reports to write, so there'll be a lot of monitoring data available. Sure. And we do have a website, which is, if you just type in UCSB Open Space, you get to the North Campus Open Space website. And there's a lot of background information there, and we'll be posting sort of regular updates to that website, and people can join an email list I'm envisioning, and we'll use something like Constant Contact to say, hey, there's a new update available on the website.
What's an approximate time span that you would say that you could gauge how successful you are? Obviously, that might change depending on what the result is in the natural environment, but how many years would it be till you can say this is a successful restoration or not? Or maybe in some areas it is and some
it isn't. I think it really depends on what aspect of it you're looking
right.
at it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely challenges and unknowns that we'll be facing, and an adaptive management sort of plan is, you know, we'll be working with the Science Advisory Board long term to, you know, as things evolve. But I think the big thing, once we excavate out and restore that estuary, that's going to be functional from day one. And then the plants will establish over time and the wildlife will come back.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any further questions? Oh.
Hi, I'm just curious, I guess, how the idea of restoration came about, just because you said prior this was a golf course, right? So, yeah, if you don't mind telling me.
Well, I think there's been a desire for a long time to reverse the what happened in the 60s, that, you know, being able to reclaim this piece of land and it's as close as possible to its original configuration. So I think people have been eyeing this for a long time. I think it's just been an idea that's been out in the community for a long time, in the environmental community. And so it's just, you know, wonderfully come to fruition after many, many years.
And there's the Bren study in 2000 that looked at it.
Restoration of the golf course.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of desire to do this for a long time. And the property owner was at the right point where, the you know, golf courses have become less valuable over time due to the golfing is less popular. So I think there was sort of, you know, kind of a harmonious thing that came together with a property owner willing to sell, actually really wanted to sell this thing, and an environmental community that really wanted to own it and change it. So I think, you know, if it had been a very productive golf course, probably wouldn't have happened. But because it really wasn't and it was struggling, this was good timing. So
as one of the former golfers on what was known as Ocean Ghettos,
yeah.
There's only a few of us that are nostalgic for it, but I think this is a good use for it.
Some of them still go out there and hit balls.
Yeah,
so.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, one more comment.
I think you guys have done a fantastic professional job, and been watching this for quite a few years as I live right there. One of the issues that came up that is really important is this is a really big flood hazard area. A lot of the houses have had substantial flooding. So this should help mitigate it. And so I think it's going to be a real gain. And thank you for all your patience and hard work and community involvement, Ms. Dr. Yeah. Lisa over there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you once again.
Is it possible to ask a question?
Not really. Go ahead, Deborah, if you don't mind.
Well, public comment for this portion actually hasn't taken place, so if you want to fill out a speaker slip and then send that my way. He can go ahead and go to the podium and speak.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is Larry Lynn, and I am related to one of your commissioners. The question that I have, and we kind of bat all the way around it, what's the access going to be during the construction period? There are many, many people going across the property now in various locations and through private properties, and most of the construction projects I've been around, they fence them. So what is the ball game here for 1 year, 2 years, construction-wise?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. In fact, that's been a question some of our faculty who live on North Campus have asked as well. So there's this period of construction, basically a little over a year, and we will fence it. During that period, you can still go around the west. You know, there's a public access trail that connects to the city trails that go down to the beach. And then Venico Road will still be open. So it's pretty limited for that year. And we had this discussion, is we've struggled internally with it on the campus as well, but it's just the reality of construction. When the contractor comes in with this quantity of earthwork, we really need to fence it off for protection of the contractor's work, but also for protection of the public. So for that year, we're basically closed. At the end of it, it's worthwhile, I think, but it is one of the impacts. And our faculty were quite concerned about this too, because, you know, frankly, over the last 3 years, while the golf course has been gone, it's been wide open. And the problem with, and I warned ourselves internally when this happened, that my fear would be that we would get too used to it like it is, and then that's taking something away. But for the brief period, and a year will go by very quickly, I think it's really worth that investment in time to do this correctly. So that's the answer.
Will there be any way to access it without going to the public streets?
Around the west, really through the west side that goes over nearest the Eucalyptus Grove. So that's still open, which is just off of this property.
So all of the houses would have to use public streets to store.
No, you can go west through our neighborhood, through North Campus, to the faculty housing, and then on the west side of that, over by Cannon Green, you can access it from Cannon Green and go down through there. There's a trail down the west side of our property that connects to the city trail that runs down through the Eucalyptus Grove and goes down to the beach.
I'm more concerned about people.
All right, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I hate to cut off the discussion, but we need to move along and we need to follow our normal protocol, please. There are lots of resources that they've indicated to follow up on the project, to keep tabs on it, and I hope the community at large that's watching makes use of those resources. I think it's a great project, and I hope everyone will be able to get the answers they're looking for. All right, moving on. The consent calendar. Can I get approval of the Parks and Rec Commission meeting minutes of November 2nd, 2016?
I move we accept the minutes as presented.
Can I have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. Thank you. Item C, discussion action items. C.1, update on the playground safety, access, and restaurant improvements at various park locations. We have Mr. Woodward. Could you want to introduce him, Vito?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Tonight we have Mr. Bob Woodward with M6 Consulting, who will be conducting a presentation on this item, C.1. We also have his partner from M6, Mr. Masood Mahmood. And also here tonight, as many of the commissioners recognize, Ms. Rosemary Gaglione, our City Public Works Director and City Engineer, who has worked with us on many projects that we have brought to the commission for presentation and discussion. So tonight we have a PowerPoint for Mr. Woodward, and without any further ado, we'll turn it over to him to get through it.
Thank you, Vito, and good evening, Chairman Hart, members of the commission. I'd like to extend a particular welcome to Joanne Plummer, who had just joined us, and we welcome her presence in this group. And with that, we'll get rolling.
I'd like to welcome Ms. Joanne Plummer also to the commission meeting tonight.
So we'll be focusing on six park locations tonight. Five of those are locations that are reflected in the recommendations from the Recreational Needs Assessment, or the RNA. And we're also adding Evergreen Acres as well to that. The locations of the parks are Andamar Park on the east, San Miguel Park, Evergreen, the Winchesters 1 and 2, as well as Santa Barbara Shores Park. Proposed improvements, we're looking at playground equipment, replacement and or relocation, playground surfacing, replacement, as well as disabled access improvements, and a restroom installation at Evergreen Park. Considerations as we're making these recommendations are age-appropriate equipment, space limitations at each park location, equipment clearances as required by safety protocols, Consumer Product Safety Commission and ANSI standards, safety surfacing, for the protection area, sight lines and supervision. That's sight lines not just for those adults supervising the children at the parks, as well as sight lines into the parks from public right-of-way and adjacent homes. Sun protection, as well as disabled access provisions. Some safety facts. Each year, there's just a large number of children that are injured on playgrounds, requiring emergency room visits. 45% of those injuries are severe in terms of fractures, concussions, dislocations. Falls from the equipment to the playground surface comprise 70% of those injuries. And entanglement of clothing, strings, a hoodie, strings, things like that, and in ropes and parts of the equipment are your major causes of death on equipment and are serious considerations in our design. Give you kind of an overview and a visual of what we mean by age-appropriate equipment. Age 2 through 5, you're typically looking at smaller equipment. The height of the equipment tends to be lower. You've got activity panels that the kids can walk up to, as well as small swings, small slides. Typically, it's a smaller scale of everything. In your 5 to 12-year range, the activity tends to be larger in scope. The dynamic of the activity is a bit different. Slides tend to be larger. Often, they're kind of the twisting slides. You've got ladders, more challenging types of equipment. Arches, things that kids use to build strength, get exercise, and different types of platforms as well. By the way, the 5 through 12 is typically what you see addressed in playground equipment. If you had to look at a default piece of equipment, most of it's going to be a 5 through 12 age range. Here's an example of, this is an arch climber. This is what you'd see if you started to go into some of the safety regulations in terms of here's the equipment and then here's some of the clearances that you need around it in terms of limits of your safety surfacing, as well as just clear areas for play. Another vision of this for a slide. This is kind of what the technical specifications look like. They'll describe the equipment footprint and describe some of the clearances around the equipment. There's an exit zone for the slides, which is typically 6 to 8 feet deep, and 6 feet is kind of a typical around the equipment. Note the hood at the top of the slide. The hoods are used to actually channel the users into a sitting position because kids tend to be kind of rambunctious and they just love to run down the slides. So the hoods tend to kind of force them to sit down on the slides. Here's an overview of a typical playground arrangement. This is probably a 5 through 12 arrangement. Clearances 6 feet all around. Your slide outlet has an 8 foot range, but this kind of gives you a sense of a footprint of equipment versus the footprint of a protective surface. The idea being if a child falls off the equipment, they'll have about 6 feet of cushion area around the equipment. Different options for safety surfaces. Loose fill, sand is the most common. Pea gravel, wood fiber, shredded rubber are others. When we say loose fill, that's the type of fill that needs to be contained in some type of an arrangement. Pea gravel was popular for a while because it once it displaces, it tends to go back to where it was. The only problem with pea gravel, though, is it's kind of magical in terms of size. It fits really well in an ear canal or up a nose. And kids are amazingly creative with that, so you really don't want to be encouraging unnecessary trips to the emergency room. Unitary, which has certainly become most popular recently, is a solid surface. It's one that isn't subject to displacement. Poured in place, rubber is probably the most popular and common. There also are segmental tiles or mats, which you'll often see at some of our playgrounds, which have been used to provide a sort of interim access for disabled access. Some of the considerations as you're looking at loose fill, generally it's discouraged in current playground design. The reason is because you have to maintain this loose fill. Either you have to keep it raked back into place once it's displaced if it's like an engineered wood fiber. You need to till it if it's sand, and you need to clean it regularly too because cats tend to use it as a litter box and so do other things. So there's a little bit of a sanitary concern there. Many of the surfaces that you see around the city are sand. Not ideal as a safety surface. Even when perfectly maintained, it only allows for a fall height of about 4 feet from equipment, so that limits your equipment height. Also, as you know, if you've ever dug in the sand, You got about 2 inches of loose material, and when our maintenance people rake it, typically that rake will bite in about 2 inches. But if you go deeper than that, it tends to compact. So you really need that to be tilled to about 12 inches deep, and it's just really difficult practically to do by maintenance people. And again, it tends to be a animal attractant as well. We'd recommend poured-in-place rubber as the ideal surface. That is what you see at some of the park locations around town. The benefit to it is it provides a uniformly disabled accessible surface while also providing for opportunities to be creative in terms of surfacing. You can use city logos, you can use local motifs and things like that woven into the surfacing, so there's an identifier for local communities. Low maintenance, you know, you can just blow it off, and it's fairly straightforward to maintain. Here's some examples of poured-in-place surfaces. You can see that there's quite a bit of creativity that can go into the surface itself. There's often been like racetracks that are put into the surface, so kids can take bikes, trike bikes, and things like that, and do races. So you can get pretty creative with the themes. But the key to understand is that these surfaces are engineered surfaces, so specifications are required to make sure the surface that you install is actually meets the safety criteria for a given piece of equipment. Here's a little bit of a deeper dive into this. This is a piece of playground equipment that's both disabled accessible compliant. This right here is called a transfer platform, and what it allows for is, like the young lady here, she's transferring from her wheelchair to the platform. What they do is they transfer onto the platform, they use these handles on the platform to kind of twist themselves around, and then they can kind of pull themselves up onto the equipment. The idea is they can leave their mobility device behind, and they can basically play along with the other kids on the equipment. The idea is to have integrated play or inclusive play for disabled people. The other item that you see here too is this is a poured-in-place rubber surface. And this device here is actually a device that's used for testing a poured-in-place surface. They do something called a rolling penetrometer that looks at the deflection of the surface under load and makes sure that it meets the federal requirements for softness versus firmness, and it's kind of a balance between the two. Kind of a bit of an illustration of a mixed accessible equipment. This is actually Stowgrove Park. You've got accessible equipment. You can see that you've got the transfer platforms and that type of thing. Typically what happens is that the manufacturers provide disabled accessible equipment. It's just kind of a standard with them. But then you drop the disabled accessible equipment into a sandbox, so they can't get to it. If you try to roll a wheelchair through the sand or gravel, it's so much work. By the time the kid gets to the equipment, they're just exhausted. So, you know, you drop the piece of equipment in, but you need to provide for accessibility so the kids can actually get to it. First park on the list is Andamar Park. This is a view from Andamar on the east. And this is the entry into the park. What you can see is there's kind of a concrete apron that goes up into the park. It's steeper than access standards permit. And then once you come off the apron, you just go right into the dirt and into the grass. So if you have an elderly caregiver, relative who's accompanying a younger park user, trying to get a walker or something through the dirt and the turf can be kind of tough. This is the equipment, dated playground equipment, a swing set that's two swings, and then you've got a child swing there as well. So what we recommend for Andamar is equipment replacement, relocation. Relocate the playground to a more central and visible spot, install safety surface around the equipment, and provide an accessible route to the equipment from both park entrances. There's two entrances to the park, and then provide signage and labeling. Signage and labeling both the park identification as well as identification of the appropriate age range for the equipment. So this is a bit of a graphic of the proposed relocation. This is the existing swing set. This is the proposed location. It's proposed for a couple reasons at this point. One is you can, the site distance from the cul-de-sac is better, so law enforcement or just people looking from the street can see the playground equipment. It allows you to maintain this in use while you're building the new equipment. And then also we're looking to improve access from this point of entry as well. Right now it's just a dirt path. So we'd be looking to provide a paved path. So users with either mobility devices, parents pushing strollers, pulling wagons, you name it, you don't have to be disabled to benefit from that. It's just a good approach in terms of an all-weather approach. Winchester 1, again, a similar type of issue. We've got some fairly dated equipment. We'd be looking to relocate that to the front of the park, which is along Cayo Real. This is a view from Cayo Real. As you can see, you're coming off the back of walk here, kind of a steep little section of asphalt, and then it just terminates in the grass. So we'd be looking to relocate the equipment kind of right here behind the entry rails and remove the swing set at the rear. This is the existing equipment that's there, fairly dated, just a simple swing set. That would be maintained while we're working on the relocated playground area, and then removed once we're done. So summary of recommendations, replace, relocate equipment, provide a safety surface, accessible route connection to the street, and then signage and labeling. This is an example of the kind of signage I'm talking about. This is actually from Santa Barbara Shores Park. Describes, you know, play area, the appropriate ages, notes supervisions required, and just, you know, encourages people to play it safe. In a way, we're kind of reminding people of what they already know, but it's just good to kind of set some ground rules in terms of age range. Winchester 2, right up the street. What we've got is just a simple swing set arrangement. We got some commentary from the neighbors when we were out there kind of noting that the equipment is kind of far back from the street, and the sand tends to be visited by local animals, so they were complaining about the sand as well. We'd recommend that this be relocated to the front part of the park along the street. So playground replacement, relocation, safety surface installation, accessible route, signage and labeling. There's also a bit of a conflicting use there as well. There's a ball field backstop at the park as well, and it's visible right here at the back of the park. There's a discussion to be had really as the community is engaged in terms of what's the appropriate uses for the park. When you think about it, if you do have an active ball game going on, softball, baseball, and you've got, whether it's the existing playground in use here or a relocated facility, it's really just a matter of whether you're picking first base, second base, or third base to put your facility. But if you think about it, you know, the possibilities of a fly ball coming out and hitting a kid while they're playing, you probably want to think about, is baseball appropriate in the context of this kind of a compact park arrangement? Maybe it is with some caveats, but I think that's the type of thing that the community needs to be engaged upon. So what we've done is we've described a couple of alternative locations, which are along Cayo Real, but provide opportunities for an expanded play area. San Miguel, which is kind of on the far west end of town, there's the existing playground equipment that's here along, kind of backs up against Winchester Canyon Road. The park fronts along Rio Vista with an access from Rio Vista, and there's a potential expansion area right at the front of the existing playground that we've identified. This is the view from Rio Vista, and we talk about sight lines, the second part of that. This is kind of what we're getting at. The park is really invisible from the adjacent street, so unless someone's coming back along Winchester Canyon, whatever's going on in this park is going to be mostly invisible to someone driving by or residents that might otherwise just observe activities going on at the park. There's a bit of graffiti on some of the rocks, so you can kind of see things go on unsupervised in the park. As we look at some of the park improvements, you look at the step between the existing play area and the grass below. There's a timber retaining wall that's supporting the play area. The wall itself is deflected, looks like it's failing. You can see it from this angle. You can also see the guardrail on the top is leaning as well. The guardrail for the drop is not quite compliant. You really need about a 42-inch guardrail so the kid won't topple over the top. But we'd recommend taking a look at the wall condition and perhaps reconstructing the wall. This is a view of the existing playground equipment. You can see some of the, these are actually rubber mats that have been provided to provide disabled access to some of the equipment. And what it does is it provides access to like one or two points in the equipment. There's a disabled swing here, the yellow swing. So there has been some shots at improvements in terms of disabled access. The equipment's actually in pretty good condition. But sand surface, there's a lot of gaps in the path going to the equipment that don't meet ADA that need to be addressed as well. So we'd recommend potentially upgrading the playground surface to deal with fall height, accessibility to the equipment, accessible route improvement to get to the equipment. Look to fix the retaining wall that's failing along with the guardrail and improve sight lines from the street. You might want to look at tree trimming or some other means to kind of create some windows so you got more visibility from the street. And perhaps look to explore opportunities to do a 2-5 play area because the existing play area is really more of a 5-12. Santa Barbara Shores is kind of at the southwest side of the community. The existing play area is right here on the west side of the park, and there's a bit of open space here that we've identified as a potential expansion area for expanded use of the equipment. This is a shot of the existing playground equipment. It's age 5 through 12 and actually in pretty good shape. It's a nice piece of equipment. The equipment needs a little bit of maintenance in terms of surface repairs, safety surface. The swings may need a little bit of help. They're a little too close to the retaining wall that separates the equipment from the swings. The swings are right back here. In general, though, it's nice equipment. We were looking at it about a week ago. There's actually a Braille translator underneath the equipment that actually allows kids to translate all the letters of the alphabet to Braille. And we were actually learning Braille as we were looking around the equipment. Pretty neat, neat amenity, but it's a good piece of equipment. So what we look to do at Santa Barbara Shores is inspect the surface, do any repairs necessary, provide an accessible surface for the swing set, and verify that the clearances from the swing to the play area meet standards and explore opportunities to develop a 2-5 play area since the existing is more of a 5-12. Evergreen Acres, this is a new one that got added for the purpose of creating a restroom facility for the park. It's a fairly high-use park with a lot of different functions, so we'd be looking to install a permanent restroom with a multi-user restroom facility. Likely be a two unisex restrooms, family type restroom, gender neutral. Provide water service from the existing park service, sewer connection out onto Evergreen, and just kind of coordinate the location with existing facilities that are already identified in the RNA. Here's a shot right out of the recreational needs assessment. There's the field facility that the RNA kind of envisions as a formalization of the existing. There's the existing playground. There was a potential parking lot identified, so we'd look to kind of shoehorn the restroom right there along Evergreen. The idea is you would have fairly ready access from the distant points of the park, the playground, or the tennis court to the restroom, so it's a fairly centrally located facility. The existing park is served by two portable restrooms, which are used some of the time, but not all the time. So there's some sanitation issues there. So this would help solve some of those, as well as providing a formalized restroom facility. So as we're looking to design the restrooms, we'd likely do two single unisex restrooms. There might be a multi-accommodation option depending on what the demand is. Finalize the location. Talk a little bit about amenities. We do a water fountain. Do we provide lighting? Is just a localized lighting for security? Design construction, similar to what was proposed for a Rancho La Patera, we do a precast option just for speed of construction and ease of specification and design. And finally, some resources. Great resources from Consumer Product Safety Commission as well as the U.S. Access Board. We kind of used some of their diagrams and such tonight with some credits to that, but these are just great resources in terms of further reading. And our recommendations at this point are review options for the playground facilities replacements that we're looking to do for Andamar and Winchester's 1 and 2, as well as review options for expansion at San Miguel and Santa Barbara Shores parks. Solicit feedback from the adjacent communities in terms of what their wants are, what are their demographics, and what are their needs in terms of play-appropriate, age-appropriate equipment. So our request of the Park and Rec Commission is approve staff to engage the public in selection of some play activities to be installed at different parks locations. Public Works will provide support in terms of developing specifications for the equipment based on accessibility surfacing requirements, and will also go out and solicit proposals for the equipment so that we can properly procure everything and handle that for neighborhood services. And with that, we'll entertain any questions and discussion you guys may have.
Commissioner West.
I want to say it's most impressive what you presented. There are three of us in this room who 2 years ago we had the tour of all the parks. So that's Chair here, myself, and I see Councilman Richards back there. So one of my questions is finding out when funding will be available and when there will be a finished timeline for this, because it is something that as a commission we have been concerned about for quite some time already and would like to see a completion date. And then a second question would be, is funding already there? And then if it isn't all in full, then how do you all plan to prioritize which park gets handled first? And then my last thing is, when we toured, we saw many picnic benches that looked horrifying. So I noticed that was not a part of this presentation, but I was wondering if you all looked at them, because we noticed many that either they needed to be totally eliminated or updated and replaced.
So I'll take the last one first. In terms of the amenities, as I call them, which are benches, tables, that type of thing, we were not focusing specifically on those. However, I think that really as we look at each park location, we'd really have to wrap that into the discussion. If there are some aging facilities or things that need to be dealt with at the same time, it kind of makes sense to capture that in the same project. Things like even simple items like refuse bins and doggy bags and those types of things, when you provide them, they're very well used, and it really goes a long way to improving the experience. In terms of dollars, the intention would be to provide funding through the park's DIF fees, but the process that we're looking to do is to go out and engage the community in terms of really what level of improvements they're looking for at these different locations, get some affirmation from them, and then put together some preliminary budgets, take that to council for approval so we can kind of get some wheels under this. And then I think the combination of the budgeting and council approval, looking at the bucket of money that we have in terms of DIF fees, is going to give us a sense of just how much we can do with what we got and then what else we may need.
Okay.
Hi, Chair Hart, members of the Commission. Rosemary Gaglione, Public Works Director. I just want to clarify. So we do have from last year, this year, and the next 2 years, Council set aside, I think, $100,000 in general fund. So there's two things. For things that we're just replacing, for play activities that are already existing, we'll be using general fund money. For improvements and expansions, then we can use park development impact fees for that. So we had budgeted $100,000 for last year, this year, and the next 2 years. What we will do is, as soon as we know what these costs are, then we'll present that to council and see if council wishes to do one massive project, do one park at a time. So it's really going to be up to council to budget. And the recommendations, though, your commission might recommend which park, if you have to pick one at a time, what you might want that order to be. In terms of benches, our crews have been out replacing all the wood on the benches. But if you ever see a bench in bad condition, call us. So we can, if they've missed something, we can go out and replace that.
Commissioner Jones.
Okay, so a question, and then potentially two additional recommendations. So on the recommendation that's included in the agenda, I concur with, you know, generally directing, supporting staff to move forward with what's outlined. Would like to include your recommendation about upgrading and looking at all the amenities, including, you know, whatever needs to be done per park. Also for Winchester 2, about the baseball field, I wondered if when, you know, maybe adding into that recommendation, when you look at an option for maybe taking that out or something else, that you look at the rec needs assessment and is there enough space to do some other type of activity or other sports field? Maybe it's not quite big enough for soccer, but maybe there's some other active need that could be looked at there. And then I noticed, and I don't know if the city has anything in place, but the signs. You mentioned signs would be upgraded, and that's great. But does the city have an overall sign plan or sign program that's universal so each park sign, you know, is consistent throughout the city? So that's one question. And the second question is on the poured-in-place rubber surface, is that a manufactured material, or can it be recycled material? Is there any opportunity for a greener surface since it's rubber material?
There may certainly be options. Each blend of poured-in-place rubber is kind of developed separately depending on the project, because you often have admixtures and then you have different designs that you're going to be using. So there's a standard that it's tested to make sure it's compliant in terms of how cushiony it is. But I'm sure that there are options for using recycled materials as well. In terms of signage, I couldn't speak to whether there's a signage program. I don't believe that there is for uniform signage. Probably worth looking at something that's going to be consistent from location to location.
Yeah, I'd like to include a recommendation to take a look at that, not necessarily with this proposal for the parks, but maybe as a separate item for the city to consider. I just think it looks better when a city has that universal signage throughout all of their parks.
Yes, and that's something that the commission can weigh in on. We currently do not have any standard sign plans.
Did you get all your questions answered? Okay.
I'm good.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to make sure I'm on here. $100,000 doesn't sound like it's going to cover all of what is proposed in here. Just saying. So in terms of that, I'm looking at prioritization. I know that you're expecting to do some outreach and get feedback and so on, but just as a preliminary, I guess, thought on this, that San Miguel retaining wall just looks to be very expensive. In your assessment of that, is that a safety risk as it stands, or is it something that's going to be mitigated by that guardrail that you spoke of? Right off the bat,
I wouldn't consider it an immediate safety issue. It's a condition that's obviously been going on for a while. There's been some steel bollards, pipe bollards that have been installed probably retroactively out there. I think it's something that could be stabilized in the near term. We would recommend that the guardrail that's above the wall at least be stabilized a bit, so it's providing a barrier protection. But the thought process in terms of if you're going to do any improvements out there, take advantage of the opportunity if you're going to be adding playground facilities and address it then. But would it be a burning priority? No, it's capable of being stabilized in the near term.
Okay. Also on a specific, Winchester Park 2, you have that ball field conflict that you spoke of. Is there evidence that that's being used? I mean, in terms of worn grass or anything? I'm just thinking that that's kind of an, like we've talked about before, there are trends, and one of the trends is away from, I think, baseball, softball type activities. Isn't that an opportunity to just do away with that and look at other uses for that park?
It may be. Our original thought was it probably isn't being used that much. There was a trend kind of back in the 60s and 70s when every available park was a sandlot, baseball. I think we've gotten away from it, but in talking to a few of the neighbors, they did mention that they do see the facility used for baseball, softball, for soccer as well. So it is being used, so it's probably worth addressing, just as you address the community, to get a consensus from them on is it worth retaining or do you transform some of the uses in there.
Great. And I guess my final piece on this, the second paragraph in the specific recommendations, that whole Evergreen Park proposal, to me, in terms of if we're looking at priorities, I don't have any metrics to back that up, but it seems to be a heavily used park. I know the disc golf people are there in numbers. I played tennis there during Thanksgiving weekend, and the numbers of disc golfers were just constantly flowing through there. So I guess I'm just kind of throwing that out there. I'm not sure how we go about this prioritization process, but I would think that use would be maybe number one on that. How are we going to measure that? Do we have any, or do you already have recommendations in your plan?
It's a more of an observational metric. I mean, you look at the types of activities that are there, the residence time that people are there performing the activities. If you're playing tennis, you might be playing a few different sets of tennis, different games. Disc golfers might play a few rounds. So the time that people are at the park is a bit longer, and often the need to use the facilities is accentuated by number of people by the time that they're there. There's no hard and fast metric. It's really just observational behavior that we've seen.
In terms of priority, though, we're moving ahead with the restroom because we have complaints of people using the area behind the tennis courts, and so it's more of a health issue. So in that one, we look at everything and we say health and safety. That always rises up beyond any other need. So to us, it's a potential health issue, and so that's going to move forward. The prioritization on the other parks is, and also how much we do at one time for each park. And those will be discussions as well. When you look and you start to say, here's our wish list, right? And then you say, well, maybe we don't want to do as much expansion right now. We just want to go ahead and do this area. And then we might plan on doing more things the following year. So as the outreach goes on and we see what play activities people want, and you weigh in, that then we can add that. So it's not just a pure 1, 2, 3, 4. It encompasses all of that.
No question. And I think that the rec needs assessment gave us a template for, I guess, prioritizing some of these things. I'm sure ADA compliance is going to be high, safety is going to be high. But the point I think that you were starting to make, I think you were, was that, yeah, we have several things for Evergreen Park. You might want to do a couple of things at Evergreen and then make sure that you're balancing it throughout the community to some of the others' parks in need.
Well, the rec needs assessment looked at four parks, and the four parks specifically that we look at, San Miguel, Winchester 1 and 2, and Andamar, were listed as the safety equipment needs to be changed out. Or in the case of one of the Winchesters, it's too far back and it's hidden. And it's not a good thing. You want the cops as they're driving by to be able to look in and see where the kids are playing. So those four parks are of an equal priority in terms of the RNA. So then what it'll be is what you folks see as a priority, but also what I meant more is, do you want to, so there may be a menu of items that you'd like to do to these parks. We pick the safety ones first, and then it may be that there's a plan to add more expansion later. So it's really going to come down to what each park needs, how much of those things we can use park development impact fee money for, and then for the general fund things, and we have to go to the council and request budget. And then, of course, all of that is always balanced with all the other needs in the city.
So back to the funding, since you're up here. The $100,000 was the general fund amount. Is that the correct?
I think it was. It's more of a placeholder. It gets us started.
Right.
No one figured that $100,000 would fix all of the ills.
No, I'm not suggesting that either. But what I was curious about, so within that two-year window, let's say the $100,000 was a fixed number, you guys are calling them DIF fees, the park development improvement fees, are those going to be available during that two-year time frame?
Yeah, actually, we have it's over 4 years that it's sitting in our budget plan. But yes, the development impact fees are available. So as soon as we have a project ready to go, that's the sort of thing that development impact fees can be used for, as long as we're, like I said, adding activities. It's an expansion of capacity. It's something new. Replacing exactly what was there before, you were moving one activity and putting another one in, that's probably a general fund thing. And we'll be looking at these closely to just make sure that we're using the right money for the right piece of the work. So there'll be a portion of it's a general fund, a portion that's development impact fee.
And I guess one final thing in terms of, I guess, constructing this approach, are there economies of scale to be had? Like we talk about this pour in place rubber, if we said to the contractor, we're going to do four parks within that time period that you're in this area, because I assume there's probably not a local vendor for that, but is that part of the strategy, or could that be part of the strategy?
Yes, that would be part of the consideration, how we wanted to approach it. If one contractor were able to get more than one park at a time, then it could be cheaper. They still are mobilized from one park to another.
Okay. So at this point, are you looking for anything else from us? I mean, I can concur on what recommendations we've seen in here. We've obviously made other comments. I guess what's our next step in terms of our involvement in this process?
Well, I'm actually going to turn that over to Joanne, because now that we have a parks manager, in the past, Public Works had to go out and try to do some of the public outreach, and we're not really the experts in park and rec. So I'm going to turn it over to her.
Okay, one quick question from Commissioner Ann. I'm sorry, sir.
Is there any way that we can apply for grants from the state or any other agency, even a nonprofit that does trails and playground equipment or handicap? Is there any way, any funds available out there?
We'll be looking. Once we know we have a project, we start looking for grant funds to match the project. Mm-hmm. There were some popular ones that were available for a while, like the Prop 84 and Prop 40. Those are not available now, I don't believe. But we'll set our management analyst to trolling, okay, looking for those grant opportunities.
Because I've worked a little bit with UCSB, and they just mentioned their visitor center, and this was a state grant to put in kind of like a public place for the parking and people coming into a park. And I thought, wow, gee, I don't even know the fund, but it's a lot of money. So I just thought we should just try to really make that part of this process to get every little piece. I know it's a lot of work, but
we really hit it hard on grant applications.
Good.
And we've brought in millions of dollars. But now every year, what's available to apply for can change, but we definitely will.
Good. Thank you.
Commissioner West.
Yes, I just wanted to touch upon the comments about having community input. There are those of us who, 2 years ago, we attended every public hearing. We went to schools where the city was kind enough to entice people to come by serving nice dinners. We had public hearings here where this place was packed for community input. And I think the decision to make this a high priority by the commission has been established now for the full 2.5 years. So I would hope that we could just move forward with this and not have to take more months and have additional hearings. Couldn't we just be able to, among the commission and staff advice, go forward to start, you know, to create action rather than words, to make this start happening for our communities?
Yes, I don't see this as holding hearings. So you're going, you know, you can do this a number of ways. You can go to that park and you can take public comment. You can be here and you can show the different, because there's a lot of different play activities. And with and as Mr. Woodward was saying, you know, you have different age groups. What play activities would you like? Because basically what'll happen, and then I'm gonna turn this over to Joanne. Once we know what play activities, the commission has said, yeah, this is what we want you to go and do. Now we'll create the specifications. We'll pre-approve some vendors who make those play activities. And there'll be a certain basic price estimate. And then we're going to look at things like how many coats of paint, how thick is the metal, what are the connectors. Those are the specifications we're talking about. Then once they're pre-approved, we can put together bid packages and we can say to contractors, here's a list of pre-approved vendors. Go make your best deal and, you know, fill out your competitive bid and things can move forward. I don't see this as needing to be, you know, all of these public hearings and everything else. It's just, you know, I think we always try to get public input and hear from the folks that are going to use the equipment.
Please. Good evening, Chair Hart and Commissioners. And to follow up on Rosemary, thank you for teeing it over. We are very excited about this project, and we're very anxious to move it forward. And we are looking to seek input from the neighborhoods that are impacted by these parks. So we can go in and tell them what we think is cool and fun and neat, but we would rather have their input. And we will obviously help support them and drive some great decisions to come out of there. But again, if it's full of toddlers in that neighborhood, then we don't necessarily want to put programming in for 5 to 12-year-olds. But if it is a mixed population, then we would want to consider some of these potential expansion areas. So that's the kind of input that we're seeking so that we can move forward with the process that Rosemary described.
Great. Any other comments?
Just to add just an additional comment, Chair Hart, members of the commission, staff is extremely pleased that we received the detailed report for you today from Mr. Woodward and Ms. Gaglione, because this was really where the rubber meets the road, no pun intended, where we took the rec needs assessment and all the work that went into that and all the input that came from the residents and the commission and really turned it into tangible projects at each park that was discussed tonight to really help enhance the recreational opportunities for the residents, not only in that neighborhood, but as a city as a whole. And so it was really great to see, specifically by park, the specific improvements that we're looking at. As Ms. Gaglione indicated previously, the budget placeholder, I think, is a placeholder. But what's important for the commission to know, and also for the council as we come back to the council, is we now have detail and we have specifics for each park to help make these improvements happen. So we're really in the best position now to ask the commission for the green light, so to speak, to get this process started. And really tonight is part of that first step.
Thanks. Well, I think that you've heard from us. We've got a green light for all that we can afford.
Okay.
But I think that's the question is the prioritization. And it sounds like you have a strategy for dealing with that. So I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you, Mr. Woodward. It was very informative, and I appreciate the work that you've done. That's very good. Any other final comments? We'll move on. All right. Item C2, the preliminary discussion and initial considerations for an off-leash dog park. Manager Plummer.
Mr. Chair, Chair Hart, and members of the commission, we're pleased to have Ms. Joanne Plummer present this item to you. There was a request from former Commissioner Richards at one of our commission meetings to have a discussion about this item. And so we're pleased to bring this back to the commission for presentation tonight. And Ms. Plummer has done a really excellent job of putting this item together. So without further delay, I will turn it over to Ms. Plummer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, good evening, Chair Hart and members of the commission. And tonight we're here to discuss the preliminary discussions for initial considerations to move forward with further investigation of an off-leash dog park here in the city of Goleta. Tonight we're going to be asking the commission for to determine whether or not there's a need for an off-leash area current, and if current needs in our community are being met by existing facilities in and or around the area. We're also asking that you determine the type of facility that you feel would best benefit the city of Goleta and support our efforts as staff for public outreach when considering specific neighborhood park locations for an off-leash area. When we were doing our research for this project, we learned that dogs can roam freely off-leash, and they're the fastest growing segment of urban parks nationwide. There's a large array of studies that talks about the benefits of dog parks in communities, how it benefits the animals as well as the owners and the socialization of neighbors. And there's lots and lots of research that can be done, and there's lots of reports out there. So we know dog parks are a good thing. What we did find is that there's a lot of different trends in the different types of dog parks. Whoops. And we are looking at the different off-leash facilities that are being developed. So there's a dedicated off-leash facility that is just a park specifically designed as a dog park, no other use. But amongst those dedicated off-leash facilities, we also have dedicated off-leash parks within a current park. So the Waller Park facility in Santa Maria, that's within, their dog park is within Waller Park. Same with the Orchid Community Park. Same for the future plans at McKenzie Park in Santa Barbara, as well as Barton Park in Lompoc. I'm not familiar with the Tucker's Grove in the South County. I couldn't determine if that is a park specific for a dog park or just a park inside a park. There's also the shared use parks, which is an interesting concept. All these locations listed here below are regular parks that at certain times of the day you can have your dog off leash. That becomes a significant monitoring issue that is of some concern, because there are times that unfortunately not all dog owners are responsible dog owners, so they'll not adhere to those hours. But for the most part, that is working in a lot of those areas to have the shared use parks. And then there's also the off-leash trail areas that are around our area, and those are very popular for a lot of people. Here in the city of Goleta, a lot of our trails are in areas where we are sensitive to environmental issues. So off-leash areas would be a concern for us to move forward with, as well as the shared use parks related to the enforcement. Dedicating one specific park in Goleta to just a dog park would go against the recommendations currently in the rec needs assessment. So our recommendation, if we were to move forward with the preliminary discussions of an off-leash dog facility, would be to put a fenced area within a current existing park. So we've looked at a couple of different park sites. These are the total acreage sizes of these parks. These are parks that we've identified are large enough to accommodate a small dog park inside the existing park. But again, we would need further investigation on these sites to look to see if it's the right need, if it fits within that neighborhood, and then again, outreach to those neighbors to determine whether or not they would be enjoying a dog park in their neighborhood. This is the attachment that was in your packet that shows all the different park locations throughout Goleta and would identify. It's really hard to see in here. It's probably easier in your attachment so that you can not see much. The locations of the parks that we identified earlier. It's important that you realize that the City of Santa Maria and the City of Carpinteria both had explored the idea of dog parks, and each of those communities determined that the need was already being met by existing facilities in their surrounding areas. We did do some preliminary outreach to the provider of some dog obedience and agility classes currently being held at Gersh Park, and we discussed, you know, what the needs would be if we were to put a dog park in there, and the comments that were returned to us was there was a feeling that the need is currently being met by all the different opportunities around the Goleta area. Again, as we look at all the different park locations, we're going to need to determine which areas would fall within the We would have to look at which areas would accommodate the dog park location, what would be best for accessibility. There's concerns about parking, if there's going to be enough parking, because if there's only one dog park within the city limits, we would anticipate that we would have a lot of people coming to that location. We would also want to determine the types of amenities that would go in that park, and we would also want to be considerate of the fact that we have already some other preliminary discussions based on the rec needs assessment of what should go in some of these parks. So when we look at an example like Stowe Grove Park and we consider whether or not we want to put a dog park in there, that could eliminate or minimize the other options for active recreation activities in our parks. Tonight we're asking that the Parks and Recreation Commission provide direction on determining whether or not we have a need, what type of facility you feel might be best, and then support our efforts as we move forward with further investigation and outreach considering specific neighborhood locations. It's important that you know that the fiscal impact to include construction and maintenance and repairs would be approximately $10,000 to $60,000 for a small park, and that can range just from a half an acre to about 2 acres. And then the estimated maintenance on an annual basis is about $15,000 annually. We have no currently budgeted funds to initiate this project, although park development impact fees are a potential source for consideration.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that thorough report. I'll have to ask at what point we initiate that action. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there. So you commented that you want from us an assessment of whether there is a need. And I know that the needs assessment suggested that the needs was being met. That's what you stated. I don't recall that specifically.
No, I'm sorry. For clarification, the rec needs assessment did not list a dog park as a priority, but it was listed as a need in the community. I believe that's why it has been brought back to you, because it was a commissioner's request that we come back and talk about that. It was not listed as a priority. When we were doing the research for this report, we did talk to somebody who is currently teaching agility classes who felt that the need was currently being met. So I did want to share that with you.
The need was being met. Because one of the, things that we have to tease out here is the need being met by unauthorized use of the present parks, which is the predominant case, I believe, that is out there. I just float that out there. I know there's no answer for that, but I'm not sure how we can delineate what the need is when right now a lot of people are meeting their needs by using parks that aren't designated as such. So I'm going to take this little pause as an opportunity. Oh, go ahead. You can.
Well, I am a longtime dog owner, and I can speak for many people who own a dog who go to Tucker's Grove and the other dog parks, and I could tell you that at times they are packed. So my dog is not excellently trained, so I don't know this particular individual who you are mentioning, but I can tell you that once again, a couple of years ago, this group heard many times that our community was wanting more dog parks. So I think I would personally love to see it investigated more. I did hear what you said about the cost, and obviously that is very important, but I think it would be grand. I mean, up there on the screen, it said that Lake Los Caneros obviously is the largest area in town. I don't know if there would be room for growth there for a dog park there. But as a dog owner who talks with a lot of dog owners at various parks, I don't believe that this need is completely filled already.
Okay, I'm going to ask the commission to hold their comments so we can get some of the public input. We've got some speaker request cards. I'm just going to go in the order in which I received them. So if Janet Ottinger would like to come to the podium.
Thank you. I'm Jan Ottinger, a 35-year resident of this area and a member of Santa Barbara Audubon. We are actually rather supportive of the idea of a dog park in Goleta in the hope that it will help to reduce the use of all the rest of our parks by off-leash dogs. The fact of the matter is you have lots of off-leash dog parks right now. All of your parks are off-leash dog parks, and I don't want to single out Goleta. Santa Barbara and the unincorporated area are just as bad. Every place we go, nearly half the people have their dogs off leash, as you've already commented. And they're not picking up after their dogs very well either. That's another problem. So along with a dedicated dog park or two, we would hope that the city would do a great deal more to educate dog owners about the adverse impacts of loose and uncontrolled dogs in all of our parks and beaches. And we'd love to see enforcement of the leash laws that exist, because they are being ignored by so many people right now, and the fines to back it up. I would like to speak specifically about Lake Los Carneros, and in particular because it's just come up and is listed as one of the options for you to consider. Please don't. I know it looks like a large tract of unused fields, but that's not how it looks to the wildlife that use it. It looks like a meal to a white-tailed kite hunting for voles or a great blue heron stalking a gopher. Wildlife desperately need large, contiguous, undeveloped spaces, and we don't have so many of those still available. I can tell you what happens to the wildlife when a dog park moves in, because I've lived immediately above Tabano Hollow for 25 years, before and after it became a dog park. Within a couple of months of its opening, the red-shouldered hawks who lived and bred there for years departed. The extended acorn woodpecker family left soon after, and many others followed. Dogs and wildlife, dogs and the people who accompany them, and the very nice social interactions that happen at dog parks, which are noisy, are just not compatible with wildlife, even when the dogs are fenced. Maybe you're not all aware how unique and wonderful Lake Los Carneros is for wildlife, and especially for birds and birders. It's among the primo birding destinations on the central and south central coast. Every birding class taught in this community, and there are many, whether through the Natural History Museum, the Center for Lifelong Learning, UCSB, or City College, takes their class there because it has the widest variety of habitats, and therefore of birds, of any place in the area. People come from out of town and out of state to this place to see our regional specialties. You can't take chunks of it away and expect to retain that diversity. Elwood Mesa apparently is no longer being considered. It was mentioned in the statement, but I don't see it on the list now. But I just wanted to mention that it's a similar issue, but in a somewhat different way. And with this, the coming restoration that we just heard about tonight of the old Ocean Meadows Golf Course, we now have a real wildlife corridor, which is amazing for an urban place. From Moore Mesa along the Atascadero Creek Corridor to the Goleta Slough, UCSB Lagoon, Ocean Meadows Restoration, Devereaux Lagoon, Coal Oil Point Reserve, and on to Elwood Mesa, a real contiguous corridor along which wildlife can move without being stymied by our roads, fences, and houses. This is a very precious asset for our community, and a lot of people have worked very hard to make it so. So please don't compromise it. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Our next public speaker, Mr. Scott Cooper. If you would come to the podium, please.
My name is Scott Cooper. I have lived in Goleta for 36 years, and my family and I have owned a home in the Elwood area for about 30 years. I'm also a professor of ecology at UCSB. I don't need to remind you about how divisive and controversial and emotional off-leash dog parks can be. Witness the conflicts over the Douglas Preserve, or earlier than that, over Arroyo Burro Beach. So, but I must say in this particular context, the staff report that analyzed the options for golf parks was excellent. I thought it was astute, I thought it was succinct, and I think most of its recommendations very cogent. So thank you very much for an excellent job. I think in general that there is a need for dog parks, and I do feel that the best solution is the one you recommend, that in fact you have an enclosed fenced area of 2 acres or less in one of our smaller parks like Evergreen or in Stowe Grove. I also agree with the staff report in pointing out all the severe concerns of options one or two, which is to designate an entire park or a large area in a park or a trail as an off-leash area. And the reason is there are so many environmental, if you're dealing with Elwood Bluffs, Coastal Commission, safety, health, and liability issues at stake. So I think if you want to be efficient, you don't want to go through a very expensive, lengthy process to explore those first two options. I also don't agree with putting an enclosure in either Elwood Bluffs or in Lake Los Canero. And the reason is that birds and wildlife avoid these kinds of enclosures, as people have mentioned. And so you're really diminishing the habitat, you're fragmenting it, you're diminishing the habitat for wildlife and birds that live in these areas. So I say leave Lake Los Canaros and leave the Elwood Bluffs alone. But there is a compromise, and the compromise is purely to look at one of our smaller parks, doing outreach with the neighborhood so that the neighbors are comfortable with the idea, and putting a small enclosure there for dog use. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next public speaker, Ms. Darlene Jamal?
Sherman.
Sorry. Wow, that's an interesting spelling of Sherman. Thank you.
Welcome. Good evening. My name is Darlene Sherman. I'm a co-chair for Santa Barbara Audubon, the Conservation Committee. I also was on the County Parks Commission for several years, so heard about the dog parks that are run by the county. So I'd like to make some comments. I also agree that there was a very good report to look at some of the issues regarding dog parks. From my perspective, wanting to protect the natural resources of the parks with environmentally sensitive habitat areas would preclude having dog parks in Elwood and Lake Los Canaros, but I think it's really worth looking at some of the other parks that were suggested. And my experience with the county parks, that one of the ones that seems to work the best is the one at Tucker's Grove, which is a fenced area in a portion of the park, and it is well used, embedded separate from the creek and the trail, so it is protects the resources there as well. So I think that is the kind of option that would be reasonable. We look at it from protecting the public, the park users who do not want to be harassed by off-leash dogs, and the wildlife in the areas. And I think having an area that is an option for dog owners who want to have their dogs off-leash, it is really worthwhile to pursue having an off-leash dog area within an existing park. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I open the floor back up to the commissioners. Any comments? Commissioner Jones? Oh. Go ahead, Commissioner West.
I would like to publicly please withdraw my stupid suggestion of Lake, because I heard your words, and of course that makes perfect sense. So please don't let my name be associated with that bad idea.
You mean the Commissioner West project in Lake Losknow? I'm sorry. Commissioner Jones.
So my dogs luckily can't hear me say this. I love them. I think this, and with all due respect to Councilmember Richard's suggestion about bringing this back, I kind of feel like this is more complicated and controversial than we may realize, and I don't necessarily agree or understand there to be the need. The fact that a couple people mentioned this on an online survey, I don't think is enough of a driving force for us to pursue it at this point in time. I think based on where we have come the last couple years, based on our rec needs assessment, what things we have identified as priorities really should remain as those priorities. I think we have bigger things to focus on at this point. And maybe at a certain point in the future it comes back and it's tackled. Maybe staff, or depending on how the rest of the commission feels, does some additional public outreach to see if there really is a need. I kind of just feel like there's bigger, better things to focus on and prioritize.
Go ahead.
Is there any legal use of leashes in any of the parks? Are there signs that leash dogs are okay? Or is it just all, yes, I see some heads shaking out there.
There are signs at Lake Los Caneros about the leash requirements. Right.
That's the only one?
Yes.
The only mention that I've noticed, and I haven't seen every park, but at Elwood Mesa, there is a trail on the far north side. It says dogs to the right and no dogs to the left. So that kind of assumes there will be dogs on that beach down there. And I think... But then I would assume that means dogs are on leashes across the mesa top. Okay, well, I just think that... So that sort of always says we already sort of have a dog policy. I just think... yeah.
Is it okay if we address that issue? I actually walked in with
Bus. Please come back to the podium so that they can hear you at home.
I actually walked the Elwood Bluffs area every day. I've been doing it for decades. And so the trail you're talking about goes steeply down to the beach. And the reason is there was an agreement with Coal Point where you have the fenced off areas to protect snowy plovers. And so the city decided to make the area east of there a dog on leash area because they didn't want them harassing snowy plovers that do creep up the beach sometimes. However, it is a dog off leash area just on the beach to the west. But here I think we're talking about the Sperling Preserve, the Elwood Bluffs property. And there it's an ordinance. It's actually the law that dogs are supposed to be on leash, the same at like Los Caneros. It was a county ordinance that the city adopted when they adopted the county's provisions. So the issue there is we do informal counts of how many dogs are on versus off leash, and it's about 50-50. And so I think, you know, Greg is totally right that, you know, do we already have off-leash dog parks? Because the city of Goleta is not enforcing this law. But in fact, I think it's still important because it's a deterrent. And there are still a lot of people that put their dogs on leash because they want to abide by the law. And it certainly diminishes the number that are running around. Even of those that are off-leash, most of them are fairly well-controlled. I'd say only about 5% are problem dogs. But as with any law, those few problematic dogs create big issues for wildlife, for other people. I've seen attacks on other dogs. And all the time I've walked out there, I've been bitten. I've been run over by dogs. I've seen them nip at bicyclists and other people. If you look at CDC data, there's all kinds of 4.5 million dog bites a year. It's a big public health issue. So there are all kinds of liability and other issues at play here. But ostensibly, all the parks right now have an on-leash dog ordinance.
Right. In play. Right. All right. I'm going to actually get behind Commissioner Jones' comment. It sounds like a dodge that we table this to some degree, but I do think it's a very divisive issue. I think that's been laid clear tonight. And I think that we do have, if I hearken back to our low-hanging fruit comments, we've got, you know, better fish to fry and more easily tackled projects available out there. So unless there's further comments on this regard. Sure. Commissioner.
I definitely have to agree with you all about, I guess, prioritizing other things over this, because first off, if we only make one park, how much of a difference could that make for the entire community, you know? Because you can, so only so many people can just go, drive over there or walk over there to just to have their dogs like off leash, when in reality most people tend to just, or not most, but like there's many who tend to just let their dogs just I guess off leash just at normal parks, because it's just simply a matter of I'm here now, so it's more, I guess, it's more convenient. There you go. Because I really doubt that one park could really make a huge difference. I have to say that this would be one of those things where we have to make more than just one, perhaps two or three, depending on how big the need is. So I definitely have to agree with both of you that we definitely would be better off, I guess, tackling other issues.
Of course.
Even though, as a dog owner, it always pains me to put restrictions on dogs, I do agree with Audubon and the professor that there's some areas that are very unique. I definitely feel that way about Lake Los Caneros. I don't think really Lake Los Caneros has had what could be done in restoration, you know, as far as plantings and things like that, and that could come in time. But it is very unique and very special, and I'd hate to see any encouragement of dogs over there. And I think that ought to be something that we develop as a policy. I'm just going to state that, my personal feelings. As far as the other areas and the beach areas, I don't know. That's really tough and divisive, like you said. But Lake Los Caneros, I think the city should recognize its environmental value. And it's a lake, and that's really makes it above and beyond. And it's not like the ocean where it cleans itself. It's anyway. So I'm just going to put that out there. And I don't know. I think that we really do have dog parks. Unfortunately, they're just not illegal. So sooner or later, we're going to have to tackle it.
Okay. So back to the recommendations on this. I think that we can support the staff efforts for public outreach. I'm not sure if there's a mechanism already in place. I suspect that there are many in the community that would have input and feedback on this. Is there a standard way that you'd like to direct that feedback?
When we were considering reaching out to the community, we were looking at those specific neighborhoods that we would be investigating the park a little bit closer to determine whether or not it would be feasible to put a dog park in those locations. So if you want us to do the public outreach, we could do it one of two ways. We could do it generically and broadcast it out and just do a public hearing for consideration. Or we could hold some neighborhood meetings after we take a closer look at some of those parks and come back to you with that. But
that's actually not what I was suggesting. I don't know if that's others' opinion here, but I was just talking about, we've suggested that we're pushing this down the priority list a bit. But in the interim, is there a mechanism for those that do want to complain and or advocate for a particular site or something like that? Is there a way in which they can give you feedback?
The city has a number of mechanisms for residents to provide feedback through the city's website, also on Facebook. And you can also contact our department directly. Our contact information is on the city's website, www.cityofgoleta.org. And we receive lots of citizen input and feedback on a daily basis. So this would be one of the items that people can certainly give us feedback on. Staff appreciates the opportunity to bring this item to the commission for the discussion we've had today.
I think we've heard that you'd like us to focus on other priorities in the rec needs assessment. And you won't hear me say this very often, but I'm happy to table this item and really focus on some of the other items, like what we just saw from the Department of Public Works on all the improvements to the parks. So we did want to be diligent in the request from the commission and do the research and the homework, if you will, to bring this item to you. And we appreciate the feedback that's been provided tonight.
All right, thank you. And we'll thank former Commissioner Richards for kicking this hornet's nest. all right, so we'll conclude that item. Moving on to item C.3, selection of tentative 2017 meeting dates.
Chair Hart and members of the commission, it's kind of amazing that we're here at the end of 2016, and this is our last and final meeting of the year for the commission, but we're already planning and looking ahead. And one of the this item before you tonight is to have your feedback and consideration on the scheduling of the commission meetings for 2017. As you see there, there's a total of six meetings starting in late February, going through December of next year. So staff is asking for your feedback tonight on these dates. As you note, they are all on a Wednesday. And we also kept the time at 6 p.m. so that people can arrive and attend the commission meetings. As we have throughout this year. And so we're looking for your feedback on that tonight. It's important to also mention to the commission that at the first meeting in February on the 22nd, it is at that meeting where the chair and vice chair of the commission would be seated. And that is pursuant to the resolution that we have for the commission, basically organizing the commission. So we do that each year, as the commission is aware. So also we, some of you may be aware and have had contact with our city clerk, Ms. Lopez. The council will be taking action, I think, on February 21st. Is that correct, Ms. Lopez? I think it's February 21st. Tentatively, that's correct. For the reappointment or appointment of commissioners. As we know, Commissioner Richards vacated his seat on the commission, as well as four of the other commissioners will be coming up for reappointment. So the city clerk, Ms. Lopez, I think will be working with you more on that. So the point of all of this is that the tentative council action would take place prior to the commission meeting, so that when we meet as a commission, we have a full quorum, we have all seven commissioners, and we're able to seat the chair and vice chair. So with that, we ask for your feedback on the dates that we've indicated and are happy to answer any additional questions that you might have.
Well, why don't we just go around the dais? Commissioner Jones?
Tentative proposed dates look fine.
Okay. Commissioner Tolles?
I like that. It's consistently at the same time on the Wednesday, so that way, like, people can actually schedule things, like, much more easily, rather than if it was on a Monday, then a Thursday, then a Sunday, then it's like, oh, shoot, all right. But, yeah, thank you for that.
Sure.
I think they look great, and I certainly understand the dynamics of what took place this current year to change dates to accommodate the need. The only thing I would like to kind of say as nicely as I can, there are those of us who plan vacations and travel around the dates. So it would be nice if in 2017 we could really stick to these dates at up. All possible, so holiday and vacation plans and seeing family can be well thought out. Thank you.
Thank you. I have no problem with the proposed dates.
I have no problem either.
All right. So we'll go with those, and when you solidify them, let us know. Obviously, at the next meeting, we'll have a better sense of a lot of things, I imagine.
Excellent. I think, Ms. Lopez, I think that's all we needed, right, for this item? Basically, we're good. Okay.
Moving on, then. We've got the director's report.
If we can get that up on the... Chair Hart, members of the commission, we're loading up the PowerPoint for you. Here we go. I'll just do it from here. Yeah. As I indicated previously, there's no music, but we are wanting to share with the commission a little recap of, we thought we would change it up a little bit this year, kind of as a year in review, if you will. And staff has really enjoyed and really, I think, seen a lot of growth in the commission and the items. I think even tonight you could see that the items that are coming before you are now much more detailed and really digging into, if you will, the REC needs assessment, which is really the foundational document that we're working from. So we thought we would do a year in review. It's a fairly short PowerPoint for you, so it's not 46 pages long. But I did want to just kind of recap some highlights for you. So we had a number of presentations throughout this year. Today we received a really excellent one on the UCSB North Campus Open Space from the UCSB folks. It was really great to see that. But we also did this last year the Monarch Butterfly Season Recap. And by the way, we're in the Monarch Butterfly Season right now. We also provided some updates with working very closely with the Department of Public Works on the Bicycle and Pedestrian Master Plan, the Hollister Avenue Class 1 Bike and Multipurpose Path. We also brought in the Boys and Girls Club for the programming and what they do there and the various great things that they do in that building behind the community center. It was really great to see that. We also provided the commission with a budget update. We wanted to integrate, if you will, not only the council's actions on the budget, but really sharing with the commission that the connection between the budget document and the REC needs assessment and what we're trying to do here at the commission level and how it connects to the council and their actions. And I know they're very appreciative of the commission's work as well. We also provided and had a presentation from Gersh Park. It was great to see Ryan Harrington come out. And it's one of those gems in the community, among many of the gems that are already in the city of Goleta, to see the wonderful things going on there and all of the age groups that you see using that park. It was really great to see. We also received presentations on the Santa Barbara County Food Bank. And I also wanted to include in there the introduction of Ms. Plummer, who is seated next to me, which I thought was kind of an important highlight of the year. Even though we're at the end of the year, it's an important one for all of us, I think. We also had a number of discussion items, and this is not meant to be all-inclusive of everything we had, just kind of some highlights. But the commission really had an interest in the community center, and we had some presentations there. You'll recall... we did, staff in my department did a lot of work on the Civic Center feasibility. We're also doing work with Public Works and looking at the structural integrity and testing of that facility. It's an important facility in the city of Goleta, and it's really a hub of activity that you see there. We've done a number of CIP, Capital Improvement Program, project updates. You'll be seeing more of that in next year as we kind of, I've used the analogy of peeling back the layers of the onion. If you have another analogy, please share that with me. But we're really looking at the REC needs assessment and kind of getting into those layers of it. You saw some of that tonight. Really important, the Rancho La Patera Park improvements, which was a presentation that you received and discussion that you provided input on at last month's meeting. Also, the Hollister Kellogg Park design revisions. As you know, really the first park effort in Old Town to design a park from the ground up, working with some tremendously capable people there, Susan Van Atta and Associates, the feedback from the community, connecting with our bilingual population there and really reaching out to them and asking for their feedback. We're really excited and hopeful that that project moves forward this coming year. And I know it's long awaited in Old Town. I found out more than I ever knew about pickleball and the pilot program at Evergreen Park and the really incredible work that was done to resurface the tennis courts there. And another example of really taking a park that needed some improvement, some work, and really enhancing its usability, if you will, by the residents. And I know at least Chair Hart uses it, I think, on a regular basis now. But it was really exciting to be a part of that. And I know many of you showed up to the ribbon cutting, if you will. It was really great to kind of celebrate that special moment here in Goleta. I provided a number of items to the commission through this portion of the agenda for the Parks Commission called the Director's Report. Really items that aren't really agenda items, but they're really items that I want to share with the commission to keep you in the loop about what's going on. So we had some goodbyes this year, and I know it seems like it was a long time ago, but we said goodbye to Commissioner Richard Rojas and our staff member Luz Reyes Martin, who many of you had a chance to work with. And of course, Richard, really his passion for Parks and Recreation was really felt. And I think he would have been pleased to see some of the items that you are now seeing tonight. We also said hellos to Commissioners Ann Lynn and Jose Tulis. So we're keeping up on the wrestling stats here. So that will be a director's report item, I'm sure, after some of the tournaments you're going to. But it's great to welcome Commissioner Lynn to the commission and for the feedback and input you provided. Looking at a number of the items on the director's report, the Deltopia event, as the commission is aware, we now have an annual event that we prepare for at the city to really minimize the impacts to our residents, where we impose parking restrictions to minimize the impacts to the residents in the area of Cannon Green and Stork and Hollister and Whittier to the south. And we've really gotten a lot of feedback from residents there who are much appreciated the city's efforts in this regard. We also just provided input to the and feedback to the commission regarding Fire Station 10 and the design that includes a community room. We just had our first community workshop on November 17th, and we had good turnout. It was a good dialogue with the community. We solicited feedback we really wanted to hear because we haven't finalized design, but we're working again with a tremendous project team of people who are coming together and really working to do an excellent job for the community and for the city, and it's great to be a part of that. It's also notably a project, Fire Station 10, which has been in the works for roughly 49 years and possibly much longer than that. So I'm confident that it won't take that long to get us to get the project completed. And I know many of the residents on the western end of Goleta are anxious to see that happen. We provided updates on the Goleta Noontime Rotary Fireworks Festival at Gersh Park, another great event that takes place there. It was great to hear about and also share with the commission the first Christmas parade in Old Town that was well attended. Were you there, Commissioner Tulis?
I sadly wasn't. I was coming back from a tournament that day, but my mom attended and with my sister and a couple of my other family members, and they loved it.
It's another great Goleta event, and it was great to just work with the folks who put that on and really see that happen. Also, staff is working on an item important in the rec needs assessment on the joint use agreements with the local school districts. One of the low-hanging fruit that I know Chair Hart has shared with me. We will definitely have some updates on that. The completion of the recruitment effort for the Park and Rec manager. We also talked about the Goleta Dam Dinner, another great event for people to come out and enjoy. As I mentioned, the tennis court resurfacing at Evergreen Park. And also, just to celebrate some of the things happening in Old Town, the Hawk Signal that went in there in front of the community center. The lighted pathway from the Girls and Boys Club all the way to Hollister. If any of you recall what that was like previously and what you see there now, it's a definite huge improvement and a definite enhancement of safety for people getting there. We also saw the signal improvements at Orange Avenue, working really closely again with our partners and team member of Public Works and Ms. Gaglione and her staff. So some of you are probably saying, okay, Vito, what are we looking forward to in 2017? So goal number one, we've just listed five goals there. I know you have many more than five for me, but we thought we would just list a few. First off, goal number one, we're looking at the completion of the joint use agreements and also providing you regular updates of CIP projects. I think it's important to show the commission that we're marching through the rec needs assessment and checking off those things, completing those things that you've asked us to look at. This is part of that. Goal number two, the pilot project for the pickleball at Evergreen Park. As the commission is aware, we're doing a pilot program there. We're closely monitoring it, and we'll be reporting back to you next year. Goal number three is a community garden plan completed, and also, as I've mentioned previously, but also regular updates on the rec needs assessment to you to really show that we're doing this in a structured and organized manner and that we're showing progress and we're measuring that progress. It's important for all of us, I think. Also, goal number four, the playground equipment replacement plan. You heard that presentation tonight by the Department of Public Works. I think it was pretty thorough, and you can expect to see more of those presentations in 2017. And lastly, goal number five, the finalization of Hollister-Kellogg Park design and the next phase of development. As I mentioned before, we're really excited about seeing that project move forward, and we'll definitely keep the commission informed of our progress in that regard. That concludes my director's report recap. And again, looking forward to a great 2017. And thank you for your support and hard work this last year, 2016. And that concludes my report. We do have a little cake and some refreshments.
We still have an agenda item.
It's part of the
future agenda items?
Yeah, it is. It's part of the future agenda items. Okay. But we do want to just take a moment to just celebrate the work that was done last year with the commission, and look forward to 2017. So with that, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And I'll take this opportunity to add on to that, look back. And it has been a good year, and I appreciate that you're taking the opportunity to explore that, because I think as a commission, at least personally, I am always looking forward at the next hurdle, at the next challenge that we're facing, and not looking back at all the wonderful things that have been done. And with that, I also want to shine a light on you, Vito. I think that it's been, as a chairman, it's been very great working with you. You've always listened. You've always done a great job of getting the resources marshaled, even when the pieces are moving rapidly around you, losing Ms. Reyes-Martin and welcoming the new manager. You're doing a great job. And I do think that it's important that we shine a light on the less visible staff that is out there as well. I've wanted to kind of highlight through the rec needs assessment the maintenance stuff that's going on behind the scenes. We don't talk about it. It's not controversial. It's essential, though. And I hope the staff knows that both we as commissioners appreciate it and the community at large appreciates it. So every chance we get, I hope that we can shine a light on those efforts. So thank you for all of that.
Thank you, Chair Hart, and members of the commission. The work that goes into preparing an agenda and bringing it to you involves many people. Ms. Plummer already has made some tremendous efforts already in really helping to make 2017 a very successful year. We also appreciate Ms. Lopez and her staff from the city clerk's office in helping to set these meetings up, take the minutes, and do all the work that goes in. The audiovisual staff who are here, who record everything. And there's a lot of folks that really help come together and really help help us all do a good job. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and with that, we are adjourned.